we have a really full agenda, so I'm not going to belabor my opening remarks. But I do have some random things that are disjointed that are just interesting pieces of information. The first is that as far as budget goes, we all know that what you read in the newspapers is all real. Higher education in Quebec has been substantially cut from anything that we thought. McGill does seem to be in somewhat better shape than some of our Montreal peers and other universities in Montreal. And that's because we tightened our belts substantially in the past 18 months. So from what I understand from a dean's meeting yesterday with the provost, it looks as though the university will be doing a lot of juggling of funds and different types of funds, but that we don't expect to get any further cuts that we will have to make up within this fiscal year. So that's really good news for us. How exactly this is going to happen, I'm not sure. I think we're into complex numbers or something. That's very good news for us. Of course, everyone knows, I think, that even totally flat, we're in trouble with our materials budget to the tune of $1.5 million, so we're going to have to figure out how to deal with that. But we don't expect any further cuts, which is good news, and that's what I've been waiting to hear for a long time. No telling what next year will be, but that's good. Also at the dean's meeting yesterday, the provost announced that the university is contracting with Microsoft for Office 365. This for all students. This is going to be really interesting. It's going to be free. Students and everybody will be able to get up to 5 copies of it for 5 devices. Now that's revealing, I think, of what our life is like, right? You've got an iPhone, you've got a couple of iPads, you've got a computer at home, you've got a computer there. So there will be 5 copies of this for students. So I think that not only is this a wonderful thing, students will have up to 50 gigabytes of storage. So think of that compared to what we have now. And we won't be getting all of those messages about your box is almost full and you can't get to your archives and all that stuff. But I just find it really interesting that, oh yeah, you need 5 copies because everybody has 5 devices. This is totally random. I don't know if everyone knows that we will, and a lot of it was because of input at the planning retreat from all of you, we are going to be renovating the bathrooms in Redpath. Ooh, okay. I know, that's about the... the number one request. That's the biggest emotion I think I've ever gotten from this group in the little over 3 years I have been here. So that's like a miracle. Okay, so thanks to the students and some other money that we have scraped up. I know this is like miracle of miracles, mirabile dictu, blah, 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 blah. Okay, and then for librarians, this is just too cool. The Osler Library is adding 2 wonderful new incunables to their collection as a result of philanthropy. So 2 wonderful things that were printed in the 1400s in Lyon, where several of us just were because of IFLA. It fits right into something that they needed, and they're really cool, and we can go look at them. I think we have them, I'm not sure. It's just great because we've got some people who are really, really working very hard to actually ask people for money at times, which is not the easiest thing in the world to do. But sometimes when we do, we're successful. So this is just really good news. As I said, we have a lot to go through here because we're trying to update you on everything that's happened in terms of human resources, facilities, whatever, since the last time we met, so there's a lot of stuff here. So I'm going to turn it over to Isabel right away. A lot of what we're going to be talking about today has to do with the feasibility study. So have your questions ready. What? Who's not? Oh, oh, they're not here yet. Okay, they aren't here yet. I was wondering if Chris was gonna. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
I feel like I'm working on the gap. Whatever. So, welcome everybody, and thank you for coming to today's Dean's Corner. So, I'll start with the HR update. I'm usually the closing presenter. Now I'm the first one. I've been promoted. So, some of you may have noticed that since the month of August, we have included a section called HR News in the weekly update. It was in response to some feedback that I've received concerning an increasing need of more timely information and news update concerning staff movement. So this HR update might sound like a recap for certain, but it's important nonetheless. So we'll start with the welcoming of new employees, or also congratulating fellow colleagues into their promotion. So Jillian Tom was appointed in the month of June as the assistant head for Rare Books and Special Collection. Unfortunately, Jillian couldn't be with us today, but congratulations to you, Jillian. We have also find a successful candidate for the search of e-resources librarian, Andrew Senior, who had been in a non-tenure track position for over a year now, will be appointed to the tenure track position. So Andrew, wave to the crowd. Also, Rare Books and Special Collection welcome in the month of July David Takesh as the Special Project Officer for the Safety Project. We had also Melissa Pipe that joined Cynthia and her team at the Music Library in the month of May. Cynthia, oh, there she is. And finally, Darren Crow just joined Schulich in the month of September. She's helping out and replacing Denise, who's on leave currently. So 2014 was also a bumper crop year for tenure. So 9 of our colleagues were promoted to the rank of associate librarian. So we have Amy, Heather, Robin, Megan, April, Marivon, Eamon, Catherine, and Natalie at MAC. So congratulations to all of you. It was also a smaller crop, but very important nonetheless for reappointment. So we had Giovanna, Svetlana, and Jennifer who were reappointed. And it's a special crop for me because I hired them. Those are my first hired. So I'm very proud. Congratulations. When they'll get tenured, it will be time for me to leave because then, you know, full circle. We had also 2 librarians going on sabbatical as of September 1st, so Jill and Juanita are working hard currently on their research project. So with arrival, there's also departure, so we have said farewell to a few of our colleagues because of retirement, but also career change and career moves. Mohammed has left. He took another position here at McGill. There's Amy, who will be leaving next week. Klaus, Marilyn, and Chris have said farewell to enjoy a well-deserved retirement, and Brian and Ruth have left the university for another job and pursuing another career. So with staff movement, what does come next? Searches. So we have two open searches. There's the data reference service librarian and the liaison librarian in USL, which we have finished interviewing today. So you'll have feedback and an announcement concerning those two searches in the next few weeks. Upcoming posting, and there's a few who haven't made the list, but not to worry, it's enough for the search committee to work on until the month of December. We'll have the scholarly communication librarian position and the head of copyright compliance position to fill. There's still the position for archive, the director and university archivist. There's a financial administrator in the dean's office, an administrative assistant in the dean's office. There is a specialized cataloging editor for collection services, and the posting will be up tomorrow, as of noon. And it didn't make the list, but there will be also Andrew's position in music, his old position, that will be posted, and a few other positions in archive. So please come to the job doc. And finally, 2014 was also an important year for some of our colleagues who have reached 25 years of services and will be inducted at the Quarter Century Club on October 2nd. So they are Michelle Ayotte. Hello, Michelle. Trudy Leiser, I don't think she's with us. And, well, Chris Oliver, that retired, but still reached 25 years of service. That's it for the HR recap update. Voila. Facilities.
There we go. Now, this.
Great. Thank you. Good. Well, it's been a busy fall and a busy summer. A major project that is underway that I wanted to bring everybody up to date on is the Schulich Masonry Investigation Project that is underway. Many of you in the room are living this experience, but for the rest, I really did want to bring you up to date on what's happening. You probably remember the roof was being repaired, the historic roof was being repaired a year ago. During that project, they noticed that the connection between the west wall and the roof needed repair. So the request came that they should inspect all four facades of the building just to ensure that the masonry, what the state of the masonry was or is. So they recommended an investigation. That took place in the summer. That was a visual inspection. The recommendation that came from the engineers was you need to get into the walls and look deeply at the walls to determine what is the extent of deterioration and what will be the cost to repair it. That's what's happening right now. So we had to move very quickly because the winter is coming and they need to finish the investigation before the deep winter hits us. So as I say, we're moving quickly. So work began on the 15th of September in order to finish this by mid-December. They've hired some very good architects, engineers, and mason contractors. Scaffolding has gone up, continues to go up on the exterior to make it safe around the perimeter. And the contractors are building some internal walls inside every floor, mainly the turret sections of the other three walls as well. Have to be blocked off so that they can work from the outside in and ensure that dust, dirt, cold comes through. That's what's happening right now. They're insulating the drywall. One of the big challenges was it really affected our students primarily. It's affecting several of our staff, and I'll talk about that. But we were about to lose 40% of the student seating in a very, very busy branch. So with Sarah Holder's help and her team, we came up with a plan to relocate a section of the engineering collection to Curry, and current materials stayed in the branch in order to ensure that we could retain the same number of seats for our students, and if we're lucky, some additional seats will be in there. So we're relocating those seats on the fifth and the third floor. Just some facts about what's happening. It's going to be noisy. It's probably not noisy yet. We've negotiated with the contractor, so they're going to do their very, very heavy drilling between 6:30 and 10:30 in the morning. But there will be noise between 6:30 and 2:30. Masonry work is noisy, but we kind of live within a noisy world. You can hear the street outside, but they did a thorough inspection for asbestos. There is none. So we don't have to worry about that or deal with that. There was some lead-based paint discovered behind some of the gypsum walls, and they're carefully removing those in a secure way. So a communication plan was developed. We have signage. All the floors, the library remains open. We have closed the fifth floor this week while they build the interior walls, and we'll probably close the fourth floor for a few days while they build the interior walls on the fourth. Scott's has been engaged, and they're moving the engineering materials, primarily bound journals, some monographs, and Sarah has worked out a retention plan for current materials to stay on the floor. Sadly, we've had to relocate, or we will be relocating, the four of the life sciences librarians out of the turret. The turret's especially a sensitive area where they're doing a lot of inspection. So they're closing the turret off, and that's where the four librarians sit. So they're being merged into two other offices, and Sarah and Rob are graciously sharing an office too. So that's wonderful. Just a note, and it's something we've said to the staff here in Redpath during the curtain wall project. If it's too noisy for you to do your work, we will find other spaces for you to relocate to should you need to. So work with Sarah if it's not possible to stay where you are. Just to give you a picture of the Schulich fifth floor, that's the campus side. This is Sherbrooke Street, the north side here. So you're all familiar with the turret. Any place you see green, that's where the temporary wall is going up. So you can see the turret is completely blocked off, and all the seating that was in here we're losing, so we're relocating the seats elsewhere. On the south side, on the west side, what we've done is, this is the fifth floor, this is the engineering section that I talked about. The books have been boxed up, the shelves are being moved, and this will all become study space. So we're very pleased that our students will be able to continue working. Now, we have other news, and I'm going to ask Francisco any questions about that while I'm dealing with that big issue. If you have any at the end, feel free.
Okay, on my end, aside from Schulich, I just want to brief everyone with the other projects that are still ongoing. I start first with the one for Osler, which right now the construction is still ongoing. The plan is to reopen as of January 2015. That means moving back the books, the regular collection, moving back the rare material to its original place, and that is to happen in between so that we can open for January 15. Osler staff continues to offer services, so if you have any requests, I mean, you can reach them either by phone or by email. Chris and all the staff, some are relocated here in McLennan, fourth floor, in the Red Brooks area. But if you need them, just feel free to give them a call, send them an email. They'll be able to help you. In regards to the curtain wall, which is the work that is happening all in here, so far what I can update on that is that the project is still on schedule. As you know, there was asbestos abatement in the section. Everything went well. It was done in the first 2 weeks of the project. There were some additional demolition at this level where the glass wall joins the building. But so far, everything is going on schedule. We were just waiting on the glass because they're going to be, when they're reinstalling the partitions, they're going to come pre-built and they're just going to install on site and then seal the area accordingly. But it's going well. Yesterday, you saw with the fire drill, I mean, we really need to keep this area open so that if there's any traffic, I mean, make sure that there's no bottleneck in that section. McTavish, which is the noise that you currently hear out there. Just to remind you that this is a project directly coming from the City of Montreal. You can visit their website. If you go to this link, you can see the Ville de Montréal website. So far, the news that we know is that it's still going to continue well in October. The city has asked us as well to make sure that obey the signs, the signals that the workers are giving there. Try not to use headphones. So if you can just pass the word around, just because there have been, you know, instances where accidents are close to happen, so we just want to make sure everybody's safe. And this was sent on this website. You see the message for the whole community. Aside from that, I just want to show you the Red Path main floor, which, as you know, there was the flooring was done. Here we put linoleum, new linoleum. This is polished concrete, and we revived the terrazzo that was originally in all this section. The beauty of this was that we got as well new seating. The tables that you see in this section are all new seats. Those are 24 new seats, aside from the existing ones that were there before. And now we upgrade this section as well with new furniture. See the new chairs, some tables are electrified, some there's going to be desktops, some there's going to be laptop computers. And this project was funded as well by the students. So a big thank you to them because this now came reality. And as part of this project, the group study rooms that we have all around, two of them are interactive, so that means they have a screen, they can connect multiple computers into the screen at the same time. Two of them are already set up like that. And we also have some comfy seating that, you know, it's grabbed the attention of everyone. This one is called the human chair. The beauty of this type of chair is that we can just repurchase the skin and it can be changed quite fast. Instead of reupholstering again and so on, we just change the skin and it looks like brand new again. So we try to find new furniture that, you know, it's cost-effective, eco-friendly, just so that we can best utilize the money. These ones are the bing bags. They're inside one of those seven group study rooms. So if you get a chance, go and try them. I know for myself, I've tried them. They're called the Fat Boys. There's three of them. But you know, students, they need different places, so we thought as well, let's give a try for this and see what is the response to it. Any questions that you might have for me? No? We're good? Thank you, everyone.
Diana and I are going to talk a lot now about the feasibility study. Okay. Just making sure I know how to do this. I think all of you have heard me talk almost since I got here about some of the alarming conditions in our libraries as a whole. And basically what it comes down to is that we don't have the right kind of space for almost anything. And it's gotten to be extremely serious now, largely because we are putting good money after bad. It costs, I know I say this a lot, but to keep a book on an OpenStax shelf like we have here in many of our libraries costs $4.86 a year. To keep that same book in high density storage costs 80 cents a year. So it's when you then compound that by turning a lot of your OpenStax libraries into compact shelving, then you've kind of really shot yourself in the foot because you're spending a lot of money and you don't get the advantages, all the advantages of OpenStax. We are filled to the gills. We know that that a study that we did in the past 18 months or so shows that 40% of our monographs have not circulated in the past 20 years. That doesn't even account for all of our miles and miles and miles of bound serial volumes, content which is duplicated in electronic, through our electronic resources. So we are, we're in an interesting position. We also know that in terms of the, we call it, the term now is the global collective collection. In terms of McGill's responsibility for the global collective collection, we actually have a pretty hefty responsibility because our collection, although not ginormous in terms of the largest of ARLs, it's not insignificant by any stretch of the imagination. And because McGill was the oldest true research library in Canada, we have an unusual percentage of our collection is for sure unique in Quebec. That's not surprising, but also unusual and unique in terms of Canada and the AAU. And the AAU is the American Association of Universities. Only two Canadian institutions belong. That's us in Toronto. I think there are about 45 members. So the AAU is even smaller than ARL. So these are not only our rare collections, but many things that many other libraries would consider rare and would have within rare conditions that we still have in OpenStax. So you kind of put all these things together and you realize that we've got some big problems. Our user spaces, some of them are very versatile. I would say, I don't know, a whole bunch aren't. All you have to do is think of Schulich. Schulich is not one of those libraries that at least I learned about in my library school class that's built in modulars with steel pillars like this so that you can put anything within a space. There are load-bearing walls in Schulich. Every wall there maintains some of the load on the building. The external walls, the internal walls, all of them are carrying load. And most of the walls that you see in any building that any of you know about, the load is carried through steel infrastructure in pillars like these columns. That's why you see them everywhere. We have, particularly in this building, it's kind of astonishingly broken up. We've got external walls that are internal staircases. We've got internal staircases that have been condemned and don't exist anymore, and you have to kind of find them if you take down a wall. We've got fireplaces that are hidden in walls. We've got condemned elevators. We've got the floods. I mean, we've had three floods. The floods have cost about $400 million to compensate. I mean, I don't need to go on, right? But despite all of that, the most important reason why we need to transform our libraries is because we're education. Teaching, learning, and research has changed, and it's changing very, very, very quickly. And we need to create the sorts of spaces that are conducive to learning and teaching, and the kind of spaces that we have right now simply aren't that. and they're extraordinarily expensive to maintain. So we need to envision the library of 2050, and then we need to go about constructing it. And so that's what the feasibility study is all about. It's the very first step in this process. And it's Diane will go over some of the whole process with this, and how all of you will be. There will be very, very, very many people involved in it. I do want to say a couple of things. I know that while we hear about all of the budget cuts and the retrenchment in higher education as a whole, but particularly in Quebec, there are many people who will just say, you've got to be kidding. I mean, this is either a figment of Colleen's imagination or she's crazy or whatever. Well, I'm going to ask you to suspend your disbelief. And anybody, we talked a lot about the people who have just been hired, tenured, reappointed, people who make their careers out of at McGill are going to see these transformations. I mean, it's going to happen. It's a matter of time. It's not a matter of whether it's going to happen. I would love to see. I would love throughout my career here to have shovels in the ground. I don't know if I will or not, but you have to have. These projects and these processes take so long. They aren't things that happen in a year or two. They're things that happen within 3 to 5 to 10 year time frames. Probably what we will come up with is a series of projects that can be done incrementally that don't have to be done simultaneously. We know we have to have a story. We know we have to have storage for our stacks. We know that. We don't know where the storage is going to be, or how close, how far, robotic, not robotic, underground, not underground, above ground. We don't know any of that. But we do know that we need to begin the process to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to gather up our skirts and go about getting it done. So that's where we are. Another word about money. There is nobody here, except perhaps for Cynthia and some of the librarians who have been in music for a long time, who have really gone through a building project where you start out with all the shuffling around, propose a project, have that need recognized, and then actually have it, do all the planning, and then move in. And then find out that you didn't build what you thought that you were going to build, and you had to skimp corners, and you had to do all sorts of things. I can tell you that most places and most libraries, that's not true. That most places have undergone more renovation and more library building and stuff than McGill has. So normally, when I'm looking out at a group like this, there are things I can just assume that you know. And I can't here because there are so few people who have actually had this experience. There's some with law. I mean, there are some people who went through the whole law thing. But this is a whole process that is not what you think it is unless you have been through it. So one of the first things that people say when you come up with something like this is, you've got to be kidding. How could we possibly think of spending what is going to be a building project somewhere over $100 million by the time it's done, probably? How could you possibly think about that when we've got students marching in the streets and we've got budget cuts and retrenchment? And the simple answer for that is that not all money comes in the same shape. Not all money is the same kind of money. There, in the United States, we used to say there was green money and there wasn't green money. In other words, there was money you could easily spend and there wasn't. Now the money isn't green, so it doesn't matter anyway. But money for buildings is a certain type of money that is budgeted through governmental resources or raised by an agency such as a university, mainly through bonding for a specific purpose, and you can only use it for buildings. You can't use it for anything else. And it neither adds to nor detract, well, it adds to, but it does not detract from operational money. I don't know if this, so another example of that is you, the common thing that you hear about is all of our budget basically comes in two kinds of money, restricted money and non-restricted money. The kind of money that you use for capital expenses and for things like deferred maintenance is restricted money in the sense that it can only be used for one purpose, and that's the purpose for which it was allocated and given you. Another example of restricted funds are endowment funds. Someone gives you X amount of money, you spend the proceeds from that, and they give it to you with a contract that says you will only use it for certain purposes. We have lots and lots and lots of endowment here, just in the library, and many of them are practically unusable because of the restrictions upon them. I mean, there was one thing that one fund that we had that was defined as money that was to be spent only on first editions, first printings. And I was like, what? Everything we buy is first edition. You know, so you have to fathom what was actually meant by that. So what I'm just trying to say is there's money is defined in certain ways. You get a certain kind of money for certain purposes, and it doesn't detract or add from anything else. So we need this money. We desperately need a building, buildings. We desperately need to reconceive of this. And it's not something that, it's a part of the overall financial picture, but it's not what you think it is in a simple, transferable sort of way. Lots of library budgets, you can't spend salary money. It's still in some libraries, money is so restricted so that you can't use money that goes to salaries. You can't use that money to pay for books and materials. The two libraries that I have run budgets in, you can do that. But in both of them, at one point in time, you couldn't. So this is, you know, library budgeting 101, but it's... these are the things I just have to keep explaining so that people understand some of this whole process. Another thing, and I will turn it over to Diane because I'm getting tired of listening to myself talk even. Another thing that you'll learn in this process is that with libraries in particular, this project is not owned by librarians. There is nobody involved in this project who doesn't think it's their project, and it is. University Services and Facilities Planning has a manager assigned to this project, and he's responsible for this project. Oddly enough, I think I'm responsible for this project. And I'll bet you that there are a whole lot of other people, I know that there are a whole lot of people out there who feel that this is theirs because the library is everybody's. And so there are a lot, you know, bad pun, there are a lot of cooks in this kitchen. And there will be, and that's just something that you manage. And that's a good thing. You know, nobody owns this totally. And that's just something that we all have to get used to from the very beginning. Now, Diane's going to explain a process that's very long and elaborate, but you can see that the main thing behind this whole thing is to get a lot of good information to architects who can do their job in coming up with different options and then coming up with a high-level design very quickly with great information, which means they have to get a lot of information from a lot of people really fast. So, here you go.
That we're taking to ensure we get the kind of input to feed to our architects. We actually started the project formally at the beginning of this year when we went to tender for an architect, and that was a really interesting project, and the outcome is, we think, excellent. We've selected Shepley Bullfinch. They're based in Boston, and they have partnered with EKM Architects. Francois Imond is the principal. You know him if you know the CyberTech and University Service Point downstairs and the terrace. He knows our buildings intimately. So that partnership is really powerful, we believe. Take a look at the Shepley Bullfinch site. Some of the pictures you'll see on the screens are some of their work, but they've been working with major academic research libraries, hospitals, globally, and we're looking forward to them coming on site. We had a virtual kickoff meeting early this month, and the purpose of that, with the design team, which are the Shepley Bullfinch people and the EKM people, to map out a schedule, to plan the committees and the focus groups, and to establish the first on-site visit, which is October 14th and 15th. So please mark your calendars. We're going to be busy on those 2 days, and we need your help. We need your help before that, too. The feasibility study project team is made up of the people listed on the screen. Colleen mentioned and then we'll meet with the stakeholder groups. We have two groups. A communication group, which is around 20 people. They're representative of a really broad range of stakeholders. Faculty, students, donors, alumni, I'll show you a list, but the purpose is we want to engage them, to educate them, hear from them, but they're also our spokespeople out in the wider world. They're advisory to the project team, and they're going to be meeting 3 times over the course of the project, which runs from now until May. So the idea is that there aren't surprises in a year's time. Some group says, gosh, the library, what? What happened? I didn't know. We're really hoping we reach out and get our message out. So the communication group has representatives from the groups listed here. Students, SSMU, PGSS, arts advisory, STEM advisory, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and medicine. Faculty of Science, Arts, Medicine, and so on. Research and University Relations, Friends of the Library, Advancement, which is the new name for DAR, and a representative from the Board of Governors. So that's the communication group, outreach and input. The steering committee is a smaller group. It's a subset of those stakeholders. They're composed of representatives from core library user groups. And they're really integral to the success of this project. And their mandate is to ensure that we're on track, that we're going to have them meet with the architects during their campus visits. They'll help us get input from stakeholders. We're asking them to get people onto our focus groups and to provide feedback. They're going to meet every 4 to 6 weeks, so they're going to be working closely with us. And the steering committee has representatives from, as I say, the same stakeholder group as before, but just a smaller more focused group. So, focus groups. And already we've asked you to send us names to reach out to so that we can populate the focus groups with representative people, because we want to make sure we're not just getting everybody from humanities, and you know, that's it. We want to cross all disciplines and all types. So, the first focus group is being held on the first day, and I'll show you a schedule. The faculty is from all disciplines. It's run. We're having the focus group sessions here in this building, in this room, and in the Blackadder-Lauterman conference room. We have room for 36 faculty. There'll be three parallel streams, up to 12 per group. And we need your help. If you have some wonderful profs you know, please send us recommendations. We'll make sure they get invited, or ask them, when you're talking to them, ask them if they'd like to participate. And send the details to info.library@mcgill.ca. Marika, we're already, where's Marika? At the back. And there, but they're being, and then we select from those, right? But whether they're available, whether they can come, we don't know yet. So keep the names coming. It sounds like a lot of names, but by the time the day comes, good. Students, same format, all disciplines. Well, there's two sessions. These last 90 minutes each, 11 to 12:30, 12:30 to 2. Lunch is being served as an incentive. we got to get them some way. And again, we're working with, we've met with the SSMU, we've met with the PGSS. We have a website up, thanks to our fantastic web people here, because we're asking on the website, take a look at it. It's got details about the focus groups and the feasibility study. We also have a feedback button on the website so that even if people can't get to the focus group, we're asking them for input. So talk it up when you're talking to students. So the website is now live and with that text box. And finally, our librarians and all staff have a focus group on Wednesday, October 15th from 9:30 to 11. There'll be room for up to 48 people. Please submit your interest to info.library. We really want to hear from you. And again, a representational group will be selected so that we ensure we get all different types and so on. Questions about the focus groups? Take a look at the website, it's great. These are the key dates. Please mark your calendars and please talk up these groups with faculty. Faculty from 4:30 to 6 on the Tuesday. Librarians and staff, 9:30 to 11 on the Wednesday, and then the two sessions for our undergraduate and graduate students on the Wednesday as well. And this website link is going to be populated on the SSMU website and on the PGSS website, so we're really hoping to get the message out, and whether or not people can come to the focus group, at least we're seeking input through the feedback mechanism. Questions? Thoughts? Yes?
Just, we talked about this in our board meetings, but this isn't the last focus group.
Good point. Thank you. So this is the first visit by Shepley Bullfinch. They'll be coming approximately six times between now and the end of May, developing their documents. After this first visit, should they find they need to tease out some question or issue, we will hold other focus groups. We also plan to hold town halls to get the message out. So thanks, Marika. This isn't just a one-stop shop. If we need more information, we'll definitely seek it out through focus groups, and we will be holding town halls for information and feedback as well. Yes?
Is there
a deadline
for submitting?
Right. Yes. the sessions are on the 14th and 15th. We're hoping to have all the names in by about the 1st of October. So one more week. October 1st isn't far. Next week, by next Wednesday. We'd like to have our names in so that we could do a representational selection. So if you're interested in the library and staff focus group meeting, please get your name in right away and get the names in for faculty and students that you think would be great contributors. And we'll keep talking about this whatever opportunity we have. Good. Okay. Thank you. Now it's friends.
Okay. Are there really not more questions about this?
I've gotten feedback that certain elements within the organization really need a lot more information about this. So we're going to be talking about this a lot, and until you say enough, okay? Because I really want people to feel that they're part of this, to feel that they know how to get input, to volunteer people. Not everybody is going to be able to participate directly, but there should be someone who can represent your voice, who will be directly involved in this somehow. So, or you can send your notes in to the website, because we're going to take all this input. So we will get from this process three options of what we think we might do. Those who are charged with responsibility for deciding these things, in other words, not just me, I may not even be the most significant voice for any of us, we'll come up with one, we'll decide on one option, which will then be fleshed out, and then that will be our roadmap for how we'll be dealing with the future and the whole structure of this. Okay? Particularly for librarians, but for everybody, there is an OCLC study, it's one of the perception studies that they do about every 3 or 4 years, that are all really provocative and interesting. They're really, as an assessment person, I like them a lot because I like the research and I like the broad brushstrokes of information that they come up with. The most recent one is called A Tipping Point. And I think you can download it, you can get to it easily by going to the OCLC website. But it really does explain through some really, really good research, as I said, some of the ways that our libraries are evolving and what different stakeholders feel about what libraries are and what they do. And so I really do invite people to do that, to take a look at it. It's something to every member of the stake of any of these groups and to anybody that we can get to, we are giving a whole bunch of information to, so that they understand that it's not the library. Libraries are not the library that I first started to work in. We're going someplace that's very different, and we will keep a lot of those wonderful things of the old. They aren't going away. We'll still have reading rooms that look like reading rooms. We'll still have print. But an OpenStack library generally is a concept like this. Well, it's not what's being built now. Okay. For sure, any other questions from near or far? Okay. We have a bunch of people here. Yes?
Just one question. You talked about this when you three proposals go forward. What would be the timeline for deciding which of those ones will go forward? By when do we have a plan that we know is going to be
the one we're going to pursue? During the 6-month period, that three options will be part of, will be one of the milestones, and the final design things will be done by the end of the project. So it all happens within 6 months. Yeah. Did I answer your question? Okay. Thank you. Okay. So just turning to some other really cool things. Everyone should have gotten an invitation to the Friends annual general meeting, and we have a couple of really important things going on. So this is the 25th anniversary of the Friends, and they wanted to do something very special for their celebration. And they have raised a little bit more money than they normally do. But the Friends always has a Friend of the Year. It's one of the things that they do. They honor one of themselves who has given a lot to the library. And this was them who decided that what they really want to do this year, as is in terms of their special anniversary celebration, is to celebrate all of us. And I think that's pretty cool. So they are throwing a party for us, and it's going to be on November the 10th, on Monday. It'll start out with a tour of rare books and special collections, and then the party itself is at 6 p.m. in Redpath Hall. Cecil Rabinovich told me it will be very low in annual general meeting, in AGM, and very big in celebration and party. So I really, really hope that everybody comes. It's going to be a grand event, and it's really nice that they thought of us. Yeah. Also at the same time, on November the 10th, there's also going to be an opening and an unveiling of the McGill Book of Remembrance. The Book of Remembrance honors all of those servicemen who are McGillians who have died in service to their country. And from the beginning, from when? Who's? Okay, it's World War I and World War II, and this obviously is about the time of the World War I celebrations. But you can see that these two events are very close together, and you could do both. There is a replica. There are two things that have happened. The Book of Remembrance has been copied, and we have a replica, but it's also been restored and digitized. So the principal will be here, and there'll be a little unveiling that will happen in the McLennan Library lobby. And you can attend that event, and then we've invited the principal to the AGM meeting. We hope that she will be there too and celebrating all of us. The new chancellor will be there, Michael Meehan, who will be. So it's one big celebration. Put on your party clothes. Come and think about all of those people who died so that we're doing what we can do, what we do and love. And then come have a party. Wrong thing. Okay, let me get back here. Pressing the wrong button. Okay. We are also very honored to have, through philanthropy, to be hosting a scholar, Alberto Manguel, who is this very nice gentleman right here. Some of you have seen him walking about and been to some of his classes. He is going to be giving a talk called Sherlock Holmes in Buenos Aires, Borges and the Detective Story on October the 14th, 6 p.m., Burke's Reading Room. He's a very, very, very engaging speaker. He is so fun, and he is such a nice man, and we're so fortunate to have him around. Please RSVP if you would like to come. We also have the next two lectures in our series of annual library lectures that are scheduled. Jeffrey Simpson from the National Affairs columnist, Globe and Mail, will be giving the Scott Lecture, the F.R. Scott Lecture, on October the 20th, and our Shakespeare lecture this year will be given by Martha Henry, who's an actress and director at Stratford, and that will be in Pollock Hall on November the 4th. And anybody have any questions about all of that? Any of that? Okay. Please come to the party. And now I'm going to turn it over to Ron and Mazie and our guests who will talk to you a little bit about Sartre.
Okay, keeping with the theme of money, which seems to be a thing today, I'm here representing, three of us, as you can see, Mazie, Jen, and myself. We're the reps for the library for this year for Sartre. And you've probably already received a few announcements indicating that Sartre is underway. I think the official kickoff is with the principal next week at... they call it the March of the Umbrellas, and it's on Thursday, this October 2nd. Okay.
11:30
at the Roddick Gates. So I think everyone's invited, and what it is, they assemble, and they just—it's just a way to kind of kick off the whole Sartre month and a half of. And I guess I should maybe—I would imagine most people here have gone through a Sartre campaign or United Way campaign, and they understand what it's all about. If anyone hasn't, then I can maybe give a brief explanation. But around this time every year, the Sartre campaign starts, and it's a way for McGill to get involved and give back to the community. And more specifically, It's through payroll deductions. That's what the preferred method that the committee would like to see people contribute through, because it's relatively easy. I mean, you commit to a deduction every biweekly on your payroll, and otherwise there's also a one-time donation that you can make. And And these all contribute at the end of the year to your tax. I mean, that is a benefit, so you get a tax credit. And and unfortunately today, yesterday was my first meeting of the committee, and I understand that McGill as a whole, the participation rate is about 7%. Which I was a little surprised about. I thought it might be a little higher, but the goal this year is to bring up that percentage to 10%. And I know that there's a lot of reasons not to give. I mean, we're all cash strapped in various ways, but then you see, anecdotally, it seems like there seems to be more homeless people on the streets of Montreal. At least I've noticed in the last few years, and there's seems to be a greater need for people to give back, and if we can, then I think we probably should. And that's what I'm going to be here to talk to you about. And I just met Lorraine Torpy yesterday, and she's got a long title here, Office of the Principal Research and International Relations Events Officer, correct? And She's offered to come here today to try to convince you, if I'm not going to, about contributing to the campaign. So I'm going to turn it over to Lorraine, and then I'm just going to quickly come back and explain the events that we have planned.
Thank
Thanks, Ron. I won't be here.
Yeah, there's people remote.
Oh, they're remote.
So, sorry.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you all, and thank you very much for taking some time to hear about the Centre Aide campaign. The request to have somebody from one of the agencies to come and talk to you about their work was a little in a short-term period, so they couldn't get anyone. The reason that I suggested that I might be able to help is I spent from 1986 to 1999 as director of a volunteer center on the South Shore helping to develop community groups. From 1999 to 2004, I was being used by the volunteer center as a consultant to help nonprofit organizations to rebuild their volunteer base, to do community outreach, and to do work within the community that hadn't been done in a long time, because with the advent of CLSCs, it sort of like waned off. Then from 2004 to 2007, I was the campaign director for a refugee center, at which time a person from McGill said, "Oh, please, Lorraine, we need somebody to do logistics." So I said, okay. So I came to McGill in 2007. My whole career has been with nonprofits. One of the things that I wanted to deal with is also, I mean, I was on advisory committees for Centre Aide, but how many of you people know what Centre Aide does, who they are? Good, so I won't go there. You've been saved on that one. What we are looking at with Centre Aide is the fact that they develop and they work with the communities to build organizations or to support the organizations in the community that are helping locally. So, I mean, the reason that McGill has sort of like paired up with the United Way, Centre Aide, to do a campaign together and to motivate the community is because a lot of our students, as well as our professors, researchers, deal with nonprofits. They work within them. I'll give you two examples that I find very striking, and one is the Genesis Project, and this is through our Faculty of Law, and this organization supports seniors, newly arrived immigrants, and low-income individuals by improving their access to government and community services. The other one, one of my favorites, is Centre Paul Roulant. Now, probably some of you have heard about Centre Paul. If you have been a student at McGill over the past few years, at some time point of view, somebody approached you to do the delivery of their Meals on Wheels program. And a lot of McGill students, they participate in that program. Not only that, but through our Faculty of Agriculture, they do community gardens here on campus. And whatever food is grown, it goes to Centre Paul Roulant, where they reuse it for their different programs. They have luncheon programs, they have Meals on Wheels, and that's fun because their Meals on Wheels is the only one, I think, in Canada, but I know it's the only one in Quebec that uses bicycles instead of cars. Now, isn't that green? So you can see where the approach that Centre Aide has and McGill, because McGill as a community, we are part of Montreal. We have been here for a while. probably longer than a lot of other organizations. So this matchup is a great way to get the community, the people, to get, be involved, not only through the financial, but through, as a community, collegial, everything. We have that heart. So why do we want to come out and discuss fundraising with you? Yes, everybody, there's a knock on the door, there's a phone call, there's somebody in the family that's going out and saying, hey, got $5 for me? Got $5 for me? And after a while we say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I have a community and I really believe in this nonprofit. I really believe in this organization. Why should I give to Centraide? Well, Centraide helps over 360 organizations in your communities. It's not just in downtown Montreal. McGill people come from everywhere. They come from Laval, West Island, South Shore. The organizations are all part of Centraide du Grand Montréal, and that means that they take them all in. So how is the best way? Yes, we can write a check, a one-time donation. That's fine. But then, you know, you've got to put out that output right now. I got to get that $100 out there. My month's going to be a little low. But by payroll deduction, you can put the smallest amount over the whole year. You know, how many of you come in by train, by bus, by metro, and stop off at a Timmy's? You know, I like Timmy's, but I mean, sometimes I find that it's a little expensive. But if you just, you know, and it would be good for your health, cut out one caffeine in the week, put that towards your contribution to Centraide. Over the 26 pay periods, if your payroll deduction over the 26 pays at $8. Now, I mean, you know, that's 2 weeks. That's what, two Timmys? Come on, you know. Think of the people who cannot put milk on the table for their children. They can't buy them the fruits or vegetables for their good health. Maybe we could give up one caffeine hit and put it towards that. How many seniors, because of their pension check, have to decide between, you know, some other sort of activity? They will stay probably inside their home, isolated. Why? Because they can't afford it, because they've got to pay for their food. As I say, you know, one less caffeine hit, and maybe they can go out. Maybe they can get to have an extra activity during the month. So the payroll deduction is probably your best bet. I know I'm not going to twist any arms here. I'll try not to. But if you make any type of donation, it will be well used. The United Way is well known for keeping their costs for the campaign under 15%. So under 15 cents per dollar to get this whole thing together. How did the United Way develop this? Oh, many, many years ago. Some of you probably don't remember, but they were several different federations that were going out all at the same time trying to get donations, and everybody would say, gave to him, not to you. They were spending so much of their time, their energy, instead of doing community-based work, they were spending their time doing fundraising. So they decided to get together, cooperatively decided that they would put their time and effort to doing the community work, and a new body would spend their time the whole year to do the fundraising. That maintains the costs low. So any kind of contribution you can make to this cause is great. The participation rate if we can bring it up to the 10% as Ron was talking about, it would bring us as a community that we are so involved in nonprofits, we're so involved in trying to make Montreal a better place to live. If we can do that, it's because of you. And I know that you all have a cause that's close to your heart. But see if you cannot at least put an $8 over 26 pays and help how many more people. Ron said that he's seen more and more homeless. The youth. The youth that are not getting their full education. They're dropping out. Hey, maybe we can save one of those. So, Ron, I hope that I've given you as much information, and I hope I didn't take up too much time. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And, Ron, I brought some forms for people who would like to sign up for the payroll deduction.
Sorry, I didn't mean to hijack the meeting here, but I have a few more things I just want to talk about. Just outside of the payroll deductions, we've organized four different events that we're going to that are going to take place in the next month and a half. The first one is going to be a step challenge. We haven't sorted out all the details, but we're going to buy some pedometers and sell them above cost. And Lorraine, correct me if I'm wrong, but if someone contributes $20, they get a tax receipt? Is that... Okay. So that we're going to try to start as maybe a kickoff walk up to the top of the mountain on October 7th or 21st, and go for a two-week period and have prizes for the top three steppers. And then we're going to have a Halloween creative teen challenge with a pumpkin carving contest or a gift basket or anything, and then a silent auction involved in that. And then during the duration of the campaign, a 50-50 draw. And finally, we thought maybe it would be nice to have a bake sale and staff social with a homecoming for retirees. And if they're willing to bake some goods to bring in, so much the better. We'll try to sell it in the, we'll sell it in the lobby of the McClellan. So that's essentially it, I think. Yeah, we're just going to be, that's finally just saying we'll probably be asking people for to help out with, to aid us with this in the next month or so. So thank you for your time, and good afternoon.
So thank you very much, and I think we're done, unless we have any questions about anything. Okay, thank you all very much.